Okay. Mr. Connell, you represent Jennifer McKechnie. And you may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Jim Connell, and I represent Ms. Potechka, who is the defendant petitioner. Ms. Potechka seeks review of the Court of Appeals decision, which reversed the trial court's order suppressing evidence obtained as a result of a search of Ms. Potechka's coat pockets by the police on March 16, 1997. The Court of Appeals held that a driver's consent to a search of his vehicle includes the right to search a passenger's belongings in the vehicle. It is Ms. Potechka's position that a driver's consent to the search of a vehicle following a routine traffic stop does not justify the warrantless search of the passenger's personal belongings located in the vehicle. This case involves one of the few exceptions to the Fourth Amendment rule that warrantless searches are per se unreasonable. Each of those exceptions has a constitutional justification for not requiring a warrant. And each exception has requirements that must be met for the exception to be valid. This case involves the consent exception. The constitutional justification for the consent exception is that individuals have the right to voluntarily waive their Fourth Amendment protection. The usual proof requirements are, first, that consent is actually given. Second, that the consent is voluntary. And third, that the search is limited in scope to the consent given. In this case, Judge Fleischauer found that Ms. Potechka gave no consent to the officer of the search of the pockets of her coat. The state argues that the only consent necessary is the driver's consent. Consent searches, where consent is given by a third party, have been held valid, but only where the state establishes that the searching officers reasonably believed that the consenting person possessed authority to consent to the search, and that facts existed at the time of the consent which established that the consenting person did have such authority. Third-party consent may only be given by a person who possesses common authority based on mutual use by persons generally having joint access and control for most purposes.
Mr. Connell, as you were speaking, I was just thinking about the U.S. Supreme Court decision within the last year or so, Wyoming versus Houghton. And in that particular case, as I'm sure you know, the U.S. Supreme Court, on a probable cause determination, allowed the search of a vehicle, including the belongings of a passenger. And I'm wondering why this is any different. What's the difference, whether it's probable cause or it's consent?
I believe it's the difference is based upon the constitutional justification for the exception. The state argues that these policy reasons that the court, like the Supreme Court, have adopted in other contexts should apply to this case. The policy reasons generally given, or the constitutional justification for an automobile exception search, a probable cause search, is the mobility of the vehicle, that is, that it can be moved out of the vicinity, and the need to preserve evidence of crimes for which probable cause exists. Those justifications are not present in a consent search situation. In a consent search, presumably the driver who gives consent can withdraw that consent at any time and get in the car and move away. In a consent search situation such as that present here, there's no probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed or that evidence of a crime exists or that evidence of a crime might be destroyed. So I believe that those justifications that justify the decision, the exception for automobile searches, don't apply in a consent search situation. Consent searches, I believe, are based on a waiver of a constitutional right, and the relinquishment of that right has to be personal and it has to be voluntary. And I think that is the difference between Wyoming versus Houghton in the case before this court.
Let me ask, because you have kind of a mixture here of both, quote, probable cause and a consent search. In other words, the officer stopping the vehicle for this violation, lack of front license plate, then began to notice certain things. Does that turn a consent search into a probable cause search? In other words, the officer found a gun which he originally thought was real. If I'm on the right case here, if he found a scale which the driver said was used for, I think, mailing things out. He noticed the position or the location of the passengers who at the time he stopped it, he didn't know there were that many passengers. He apparently got some further information. Is there any change there from what the officer was observing? Yes, and then he asked for a pat down, which is the consent that we're talking about and talking about with Justice Crooks. But wasn't there a kind of a, I won't say subtle change, didn't things kind of change on the scene here?
I believe they did, and I believe they changed in a manner that supports our position in this case.
Okay.
Certainly, the officer had a reason to stop this van. It didn't have a front license plate.
Right.
And the officer testified that he noticed what I think was described as a furtive motion. The driver apparently explained to the officer he was getting his license out of a backpack, and he had the license in his hand when he approached the officer. The officer then searched the compartment around the driver's seat and found no contraband. During the traffic portion of this stop, the officer did not, although he observed the passengers in the vehicle and apparently asked to see their hands originally, he did not ask for a consent to pat down those persons, and he did not conduct a pat down. After the officer completed the traffic investigation, he issued a warning, and he told the driver he was free to leave. I believe that at that point, there was no probable cause. I don't think anyone argues probable cause. The state, although they didn't argue this in their argument in the Court of Appeals, now in this court argues that this is a case governed by Terry versus Ohio, that this is a stop and frisk case. But I don't believe that the evidence in this case supports the state's argument. Judge Fleischauer's finding must be accepted unless it's clearly erroneous. And his finding was there was no reasonable suspicion of illegal conduct. In order for Terry versus Ohio to apply to this case, two conditions have to be met. Those conditions are codified in our statutes, 968.24 and 968.25. The first condition is that must be met is the officer must have reasonable suspicion to believe that a person is engaged in a crime. On page 33 of the transcript of the suppression hearing in this case, this question was asked of the officer who performed the search. At the time you actually searched Ms. Matechka's coat, you did not have any suspicion after conducting the pat search of her person that she had committed any criminal activity. And his answer was, on that day, correct. There was no, at the time that this search was performed, there was no reasonable suspicion of any illegal activity. The second step in the Terry analysis is that the officer must have reasonable suspicion to believe that the person is armed and dangerous.
Well, let me just go back to that first step. It's my understanding that when the word crime is used there, it includes a traffic offense, which is not a crime.
Well, Judge, Your Honor, in fact, in this case, the traffic offense had been taken care of at the time Ms. Matechka's
right.
was searched. The traffic stop was over.
Right.
There was no crime. There was no no illegal activity that the officer was investigating.
Given the driver a warning citation, isn't that right?
That's correct.
And so under another U.S. Supreme Court case, he had no right giving him a warning citation to make a search because the search could only be made under after an arrest had been made. So he now has a warning citation and he's proceeding further. But you didn't make the argument at the trial court, did you, that this consent was invalid? Or are you making it now that this consent was invalid? I mean, it seems to me the traffic officer has made a perfectly legitimate traffic stop. You don't have a front plate. And now has proceeded into a search of a backpack, a search of four people who were in the van, a pat-down search of them, pat-down search of the driver, pat-down search of the other person in the passenger seat. So we've now had a pat-down search of six people, and now we are proceeding to search garments in the car, right?
That's correct.
All because he got a citation for not having a license plate. You think they would have done that to Justice Babbage?
No.
Why not?
Well, Judge, Your Honor, what we know, my daughter's here, and within the last year, she and I both received a speeding citation within the same month.
Shocked.
It was our first. But
that's what they all say. Go ahead.
Both of us were traveling into this state from trips, and both of us had cars full of luggage. I was with my wife, two middle-aged white people. My daughter was with her younger sister and an African-American. Guess which of those two cars was the police asked to search? Guess who had to stand at the side of a busy highway for an hour while their luggage was searched piece by piece? These types of searches, I think, invite types of discrimination that we ought to discourage. They invite searches that are directed at people who are nonconformists or who belong to minority groups. Everybody knows the justifiable outrage that many people have in this country over the offense that's, I guess, euphemistically known as driving while black. And I think that these types of consent type searches encourage that kind of discriminatory behavior, and they shouldn't be discouraged. But I think beyond the question of whether the officers have the right to search every item in a car because of a traffic stop, a speeding case, and so forth, or the right to ask for consent. They clearly don't have the right to search a person who's never given consent, and that's Jennifer Matechka's position in this case. She didn't consent to the search of her jacket. There was no reasonable suspicion that she was armed or engaged in illegal activity.
Mr. Connell, let me just ask you this so that I've got the facts straight. At one point, didn't your client give consent to a pat-down?
Yes.
All right. Is it unreasonable to assume that the pat-down might also include clothing that she was about to put on? My understanding is that several of these people asked for their jackets from the car, indicated that they were cold, and as the jackets were going to come out and be given to them, the officer checked the jackets.
That's correct. That's what happened. Ms. Matechka never asked for her jacket, but as these jackets were being apparently passed out of the car, they were searched. The justification for a Terry-type search would be a search for weapons. In fact, the officer placed his hands in the pockets of these coats and found paraphernalia in Ms. Matechka's pocket. The state does contend that by consenting to this risk of her person, that Ms. Matechka also consented to the search of her coat, which had been left in the van.
Let me just follow up, because we're talking about clothing. I mean, if you have four people in the van and they all walk out fully clothed, and one comes out without a pair of shoes or socks or shirt or pants or something like that, are you saying that and they give consent, then the position you would have would be that any further search, if the pants are in the car, or the shirt, or the coat, then you'd have to ask again, may I search your shoes? May I search your socks? Which, you don't have socks on, other people are wearing socks. You take people just as, well, I'm trying to think what the reasonable officer would do when now he knows, he or she knows, that there are further items of clothing within the vehicle.
Well, I think that the scope of the consent is limited to the consent that Ms. Matechka gave. The record isn't real extensive about what the exchange was between the officer and Ms. Matechka, but it sounds like the officer says, do you mind if I pat you down? And her answer is okay. The state argues that it was reasonable for the officer to believe that Ms. Matechka consented to the search of her coat, but the evidence presented at that suppression hearing doesn't support that contention. No evidence was presented by the state that the officer believed that he had Ms. Matechka's consent to the search of her personal belongings. And of course, the search went on to beyond the coat pockets, it went into her purse and so forth as well.
I guess that's what I'm trying to distinguish between, quote, personal clothing that would ordinarily be worn in, say, a duffel bag or something else in the vehicle. Now, if that's why I was just posing, and maybe I'm speculating or just asking you, but if people are dressed, if I had contraband, I mean, I don't know, we can't look at it that way, but if obviously, I would not want to bring it out, and especially if I was wearing a swimming suit or less than other, you know, just leave it in the vehicle, because you're saying that if there's once consent given, but it only extends to the pat down of the person, whatever they're wearing at the time they give that consent.
I believe that's correct. And that if the officers want to go beyond that and search other personal belongings, including clothing, that they have to ask for that consent. And it would have been a simple matter in this case. They searched each jacket and then said, who does this belong to? They knew, of course, And the judge, Judge Fleischauer, made a finding that the officer knew that Ms. Matejka, that this jacket was not the driver's jacket. They were different sexes and so forth. So, yes, I believe that the consent has to be within the scope of the consent given. And the scope of the consent in this case was to frisk this lady outside her vehicle.
Counsel, could I go back to the issue of the scope of the third-party consent, which is really the main issue in this case? What if instead of riding around in a van with a number of other people, your client was sharing a room with a number of other people, and her jacket was in that room, and someone that she was sharing the room with gave consent to the police to search the room? Would the police have been justified, and would it have been legal for them to search the jacket which they found within the room pursuant to the third-party consent under those circumstances?
Well, you know, in searches of premises, the court has said recently, this court in State versus Kiefer, that it is access to or control over the property that governs the search. And Kiefer, the father-in-law landlord, was not could not consent to the search of his son-in-law's room. It seems to me that a consent search, though, of any premises, whether a car or a house, ought to be limited to the property of the person whose consent is given. If there is joint access or control, if we both use the safe in the corner of the room to store our belongings or the dresser or something of that nature, then I guess under State versus Kiefer, the police would have the authority to search. If it was some item, I believe, that was of personal belongings, then that consent wouldn't be valid, that third-party consent.
Well, didn't the United States Supreme Court say differently in the Matlock case? The situation I just described is basically the Matlock case,
well,
isn't it, where the police had valid third-party consent to search a room, and within an object, and I think in that case it was a diaper bag, inside of that room they found the contraband in question, and the Supreme Court didn't engage in an item-by-item analysis about whether the consent, the third-party consent to search the room, extended to different objects in the room. They just said she stopped the cops of third-party consent validly obtained, voluntarily obtained, to search the whole room under which there was, or over which there was common authority to grant that consent.
Well, I think the Supreme Court's finding was based on the fact that the wife or common law wife or whoever the lady was who gave consent in the Matlock case had the use of and access to and control over the premises, including the bag that was searched.
Well, why wouldn't the same rationale apply here? The driver has authority over the vehicle, and presumably that encompasses the premise that he has the authority to consent to the search of anything in the vehicle.
I don't think that's the logical next step. I don't think when a person walks out of their home and into a car, that they lose the exclusive use or exclusive right to control their personal belongings. Their personal belongings, such as the pockets of their coat or a purse that a woman may be carrying or a briefcase that someone was carrying. I don't think that by getting into the car that you lose your expectation of privacy in those items.
But the expectation of privacy is certainly significantly less than that in a home or a premises or a room. And
that,
so if the U.S. Supreme Court says it's okay in Matlock, and the expectation of privacy is lessened in a vehicle.
Well, I think, Your Honor, that the difference is the element of access to or control over the item, and I don't think that the driver of that car had control over Jennifer Matejka's coat.
Well, the other difference in Matlock is that the co-owner was not present. So here she is, she's got joint custody of the house, and this is a bedroom in which they both occupy. He's not there. She says, go ahead. In this case, Mr. Matlock is present, and if you want to search what he says belongs to him, you should ask him. I mean, I think that Matlock may not be on all fours because of the absence of the owner. Besides, when I go into a car, I don't expect that the driver has authority over my person or purse. I guess I have the same feeling about my husband, but that's another story.
Mr. Matlock actually was under arrest.
That's right. That's right. He wasn't present. It was Mr. Matlock. Go ahead.
Mr. Connell, suppose the driver of the van had been arrested for operating under the influence. Could there have been a search of the passenger's coats under those circumstances?
Well, I think you could reasonably read the recent decision of this court in State versus Cologne of justifying that search incident to arrest, but I think that a consent is a different situation because of the justifications. In Pallone, of course, this court said that a search incident to arrest has as its justifications officers' safety. That is an arrest situation with its proximity and stress, etc. It presents some sort of dangerous situation. Certainly a consent search like we had in this case doesn't present the volatility that an arrest might give. So I think that this case can and should be distinguished from cases in which there's a search incident to an arrest for whatever reason the arrest is made. The state finishes its argument in its brief talking about the reasonable expectation of privacy of Ms. Matechka. Oh, I see that I've reached the end of my time, so I'll...
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Assistant Attorney General Nashel, representing the state of Wisconsin, Ms. Nashel.
May it please the court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Jennifer Nashel, and I represent the state of Wisconsin in this case. I'm going to begin by talking purely about consent searches here. Defense counsel and I agree on the basic standards regarding consent searches. We both agree that it involves an inquiry into issues such as authority, control, access to, and that's why the state has no quarrel with a lot of the cases cited by defense counsel in its brief, including Rodriguez, Chapman, Stoner, Kiefer, because they basically simply employ these standards of access and control. The question, however, is access over what? Access to what? Control and authority over what? And the fundamental difference between defense counsel and the state on the issue of the scope of consent is this. The state believes that if a person has the requisite authority and control over the premises, then that person can give consent to search all of the property on those premises, whether the premises are a vehicle or a house.
Okay, counsel. Assuming that, would the driver here have the legal authority to consent to a search of the persons in the vehicle?
No, I think that persons have been afforded special protection by, they're not containers, they're not belongings, they are afforded special protection by virtue of the fact that they are separate people. And the courts have made distinctions in the context of search incident to arrest, search incident to probable cause.
Well, what if one of the persons was wearing a jacket? Could the driver have given authority, consent to search the jacket?
If the jacket is on the person, the state would not be arguing that you can search the jacket on the person.
What if the jacket is on the side?
On the side of the person?
Yeah.
And the person has not left it.
The person doesn't have it on, but it's right there hanging over the back of the seat.
And you're assuming that the person is in the vehicle, or doesn't it matter?
Person's in the vehicle.
If it's not on the person, that it would be subject to search. And if a purse is on a person, if a jacket is on a person, it would not be subject to search. But if it's in the vehicle as a separate item, it is subject to search. And the defendants...
We've had some cases that, and I'm sorry, I can't recall them, but maybe there are some in the brief that are cited, where the woman has a handbag. And that's viewed as not searchable. It's on her. Do you agree with that?
If the purse is on her person, and are we talking about consent searches or other contexts? In all contexts, I think the courts have been clear that if the handbag is on her person, that it's not subject to search.
And if it's a foot away, and I'm in Justice Babbage's home, police come and he says, "Oh yeah, go ahead. You can search anything that belongs to Abrahamson. That's her purse. That's her jacket." And I say, "No."
I believe that that's where the courts have drawn the line. If it's not on the person, it is subject to search, and that's what this court did in Andrews as well, in a search incident to a warrant
in
a home.
But we moved away. Will it stay with consent? Because you agree, or maybe you disagree, and I'll ask you, do you agree that it's different on consent and versus arrest or warrant?
I agree with defense counsel that the theoretical underpinnings are different, but the rights vis-a-vis the passenger or the guest or the co-tenant, I don't think are different. I think that is what's driving these cases, is the reasonable expectation of privacy of these parties who did not give consent, who were not arrested, who did not create at all any probable cause.
You don't think I have a reasonable expectation in my jacket or my purse, even if it's not on me, when I'm in his home?
I think that the state's position that item is subject to search based on either Justice Babbage's consent or if his home is subject to a warrant, that it is...
Warrant is just
okay,
different.
Okay, that in that context, yes, I think that it can be searched.
Counsel, other states that have recently addressed fact situations that deal with consent search in a vehicle of personal belongings of a party other than the one who gave the consent, driver gives consent, personal belongings of a passenger. The state court decisions are contrary to your proposition.
Some of them are, and those were cited by defense counsel.
The majority
and some of them,
the state court decisions that deal with consent of a vehicle search, consent given by the driver of a vehicle to search the personal belongings of a passenger, the majority of those jurisdictions have held contrary to what you're arguing. Isn't that correct?
I did not find in my research an overwhelming majority. I think it is fair to say that the state courts that have addressed this pre-Houghton have said that that a driver's consent cannot extend to a passenger's belongings.
Well, July 10th of this year, 2000, the Indiana court had the fact situation
right
on point.
That was the one case, and as I stated in my brief, Indiana as far as I know, the courts are still divided on that issue.
Well, counsel, in your brief, you were talking about the Indiana case, the State versus Friedel, which is an Indiana Court of Appeals 1999 case, which held exactly contrary to your position. You raise in your brief the suggestion that maybe Indiana is equivocal about this, but on July 10th, in the State versus Norris case, they exactly the opposite of what you are arguing. There, the state trooper had, I think it was a backpack next to a passenger, a backseat passenger, consent with the driver, and they reiterated what they said in Friedel, and they found it unreasonable. And it was because of this whole apparent authority. That is, the driver did not have authority to give consent to search the personal possessions of the passenger. It was invalid. The officer should have ascertained, in this case, who the backpack belonged to, because the driver didn't have didn't give consent. That's in the Norris. The Friedel case is right on point.
Right. As I stated in my brief, the Christ case, which comes down the other way, does mention the Friedel case and says, you know, even though there's this holding out there, which, as I admit, is contrary to the state's position in this case, even though there's this other holding out there, we basically disagree, and we are holding that a homeowner can consent to the search of a guest's belongings.
I took a look at that footnote in the Christ case. That's footnote 2, and I guess I'm not sure that I agree with you when read in its entirety. It seems to conclude in so concluding, the court noted it was not reasonable for the officers to believe that the driver had authority to grant such consent because, among other things, this is in the Christ case, the officers knew the handbags belonged to a female, the defendant was the only female in the vehicle, and a purse is generally not an object for which two or more persons share common use or authority. That's the end of the footnote, too, that you cite. It's my sense that Indiana comes squarely, not that we follow Indiana, but has visited this issue twice in the last 99 and then in July of this year, and have come squarely against your position.
But Christ has not been overruled, and the holding in that decision was very broad. It says the determination of reasonableness pertains to the third person's authority over the premises or vehicle in question and not any particular container within a common area of such premises. It focuses, as the state is on this case, on the premises and not on the particular containers. And the defendant's position in this case is that when someone with authority and access to the premises consents, that is not sufficient, that what is required is that the officer obtain consent for each and every particular item that the officer wishes to search or have some other grounds for searching that. And the state submits that that is not as consistent as the state's position with either Supreme Court precedent regarding consent searches and authority from other jurisdictions, and this court in State v. Myers regarding a host's ability to consent to the search of a guest's belongings. And it's also not consistent with other Fourth Amendment contexts.
If the driver and or any one of the passengers, any one of five of them said, or all of them said, in response to the police officer, when asked, may I search, one or more of them said no. What do you think? Do you think the police officer would then have reasonable suspicion that they're armed or have contraband?
I don't think that just because someone disagrees with a search that provides reasonable suspicion or probable cause.
So you think that the officers should then say to these five people, after he's pulled them all out of the van for not having a front plate, you should say, well, that's fine, sir and madam. Please just get back in your van and drive along. I'm sorry I bothered you. Or maybe the officer should say, hey, I'm not going to give you a warning citation. I have every right to arrest you.
Does the officer have the right to arrest, or is your question, is the officer required when no one gives consent?
Why can't the officer arrest?
Why can't the officer arrest if all he has is that the people have said...
No, now he's got this license plate.
Yes, he can arrest.
He can arrest.
There's a Wisconsin statute.
If they say no, then he says, okay, no warning ticket. This is bigger than a plate. Let's just put you under arrest. And now he can search everything, right? And all of them.
If he places them under arrest, he can search everything.
And so their choice here was either to be placed under arrest and searched or consent.
There might be a question about the legality of the search, I'm sorry, of the arrest, if it can be shown. I'm not saying this is definite, but if I were a defense attorney, I would make some argument that the arrest wasn't valid because it was based on someone asserting their constitutional rights, just as in other contexts, defense attorneys make that sort of argument. I'm not saying that would definitely fly with the court, but...
Or with the state.
If I can push you one step further from where I was, if the court was to my right, the officer can search that. What if at the same time the officer is searching for that jacket, I pick that jacket up and put it in my lap?
At the time that the officer begins the search...
Can the officer take that jacket from me and search it?
I think that it's what is in the vehicle and not on the people at the time that the consent is granted. Just as in Pallone, it was what is in the vehicle at the time that the search commenced, at the time that the search incident to arrest commenced. If you remember in that case, the passenger was about to grab the duffel bag out of the car, and the officer said, no, leave that in there, I'm searching the vehicle. And I think that the same should be true in this context.
Counsel, do you have that Christ case easily in front of you or not? Take a look at the last sentence of footnote 2. Because you're saying Christ, if you have it easily in front of you, otherwise I'll just read it.
Okay, the last sentence of footnote 2.
I think it says, contrary to your assertion of what Christ says, we iterate our Supreme Court's emphasis that the termination of reasonableness pertains to the third person's authority over the premises or vehicle in question and not any particular container within the common area of such premise or vehicle.
Yes.
Okay. So we're... I want to move on to reasonable suspicion. I was looking at the transcript here, and there was a question of the officer. Question was, what movements did the occupants make prior to you having them exit the vehicle that made you suspect that they were carrying weapons? Answer, what movements did they make? Question, correct. Answer, none that I recall. What reasonable suspicion was there to frisk the passengers?
I think it's based on a number of factors. There were 6 occupants in the vehicle, 2 officers. The stop occurred in the middle of nowhere, essentially. Some of the passengers, including the defendant, had a criminal record, including drug-related offenses. There were furtive gestures not only on the part of the driver who was reaching for this bag several times, but furtive gestures on the part of all the other occupants of the vehicle, except possibly the passenger in the front seat, who hid under a blanket. It was not nighttime. There's no indication that they were sleeping. It was in the middle of the day, and they were hiding under these blankets. And in
opposing counsel says in the brief that it's in the evening. I know Judge Fleshauer made quite a bit of a cold march. But what time of day was this?
I could not find the time of day anywhere. All I know is that in reading the hearing, they refer to day numerous times. I couldn't find a precise time, but I was surprised to see that in the reply brief that he said it was a cold night.
So do you think the officer, when he testified that there were no movements that the occupants made that made him suspect they were carrying a weapon? Do you have any reason to suggest that he was testifying incorrectly when you said that there were no movements?
What page is that on?
Page 31, about two-thirds down.
Okay, he says right before that, did you suspect that any of those occupants had any weapons on them? And he says definite possibility. And at another point...
And then he said they were asked what movements, and he said
right.
They weren't. Okay.
Right. So, but at another point, he does say that the fact that there were all the people there, the fact that there had been these gestures made, these furtive movements, the fact, I forget what all he articulates, I might be confusing them with what I'm articulating now, but he does state in the record that there were actions that made him want to conduct a pat-down for officer safety. It's in the context of the prosecutor asking the officer, why did you conduct a pat-down of these people? And he says it was for safety reasons, and he says that he patted them down for weapons. And he says why he was concerned about weapons. And his actions throughout this interaction are consistent with a concern for safety. When he first approaches the vehicle after he sees that the furtive movements on the part of the driver and the passengers, he says he approaches with heightened caution or uses some words like that. He tells the people in the vehicle to put their hands where he can see them. He asks the driver to open the back of the van so that as he's writing the warning, he can see what's going on in the vehicle. And he says numerous times throughout his testimony that he's concerned for safety. And I think his concerns are legitimate.
How many people in the van had criminal convictions?
I believe it was 3 out of the 6. I believe that defense counsel states that at some point.
How many people in the van were on probation at the time of the stop?
I believe that was 2.
If people on probation are caught with controlled substances, might they be nervous about what would happen?
Yes. And, you know, I think that the fact that they have these criminal convictions goes into the officer's reasons for being concerned about his safety. And the fact that they're drug-related, this court has stated numerous times that there's a connection between drugs and weapons. And
could I ask this? Should the test for third-party consent to search be different in an automobile when the consenting person is the owner and driver than in a building?
In a dwelling? The expectation of privacy, as Justice Sykes was pointing out, should be lower in a vehicle than in a home. And courts have stated, and this court in State v. Meyer said that a homeowner's consent to search property in a home includes the property of other people who did not provide consent. And I don't think there's any reason to say that, well, in a home, that's okay, and including in Matlock, where the Supreme Court said that, and in a vehicle, it is not. There is a lower expectation of privacy in a vehicle. A vehicle could be involved in an accident. You could have your contents strewn around the road, and a vehicle driver, owner, has authority over that vehicle. That driver decides who rides in the vehicle, what those people are allowed to bring. The driver could throw anyone or anything out at any time. I mean, hopefully you wouldn't want that to happen if you're a passenger, but they have as much control over the vehicle as a homeowner does over the home, and there isn't a reason to draw this distinction. And I wanted to comment on the Matlock case.
Do you have any case where in a home you have consent by one owner to search the other person's property? while the non-consenting person is there? Or in all these homeowners, is that the person whose property is being searched is absent?
In some of the cases that I cite in my brief, the person who's not consenting is there, including the case where the person was a painter out in the front yard. In some of the cases, the court actually takes that into account, that they did not say anything at the time that the search was being conducted.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And let me just... Also, I think that the fact that in a lot of these cases, the reason the person wasn't there in the cases where they've said that it's okay to search a guest's belongings pursuant to the host's consent or a co-tenant's pursuant to another tenant's consent, the person whose belongings are being searched, as Justice Sykes pointed out in Matlock, is not there because of an arrest. In Matlock, the arrest occurred on the front lawn and the person was taken in. In Myers, in this court's decision in Myers, it was the same situation. The person had been placed under arrest. So it wasn't as though the person just left the stuff there and, you know, walked off into the sunset. It was a situation where the officers exercised control over the non-consenting party. And
counsel, I was recently in a taxi that was stopped. And I think the taxi driver got a citation for something. But let's say, much like this, let's say he didn't have a license plate on his front of his vehicle. And let's say he got a warning. And let's say the officer said to him, well, you're free to go now. And he could have left. And then let's say the officer said, do you mind if I search, like the officer did here, do you mind if I search the vehicle for drugs or weapons? And the taxi driver said, sure. And now what does a taxi driver care? I mean, he's some taxi driver from a big city, and here I am with my purse. So you're saying that a taxi driver, now we're not talking about probable cause for arrest, we're not talking about reasonable suspicion, we're talking about whether a taxi driver can give, who was given a warning, not a citation, and told he could go, whether his consent will allow for the search of my purse and my luggage. And under your theory, that would be okay.
That's right. And the court... members of the court keep restraining me from talking about these other contexts and wants me to just talk about consent searches. So I've tried to focus on those consent searches and show why it's consistent not only with searches of homes, but it's also consistent with cases such as Jimeno and Schneckloth and Schneckloth and Jimeno, where the court says in Jimeno, for example, that the scope of the search is basically governed by the express object of the search, and they don't make any distinction between a passenger's belongings and the consenting party's belongings. And I find that very significant that in neither Schneckloth nor in Jimeno did they do that. Jimeno involved a closed bag.
Let me say, I get out of the car and I'm carrying my purse, and the officer says, can I pat you down? And I said, no.
The officer has to say, okay. And defense counsel brought up his daughter being stopped and searched at the side of the road, and I don't understand why a defense attorney's daughter wouldn't say no. But you do have the right. What?
You'd be arrested.
I'll tell you why. A Supreme Court justice's son.
Okay.
Say no.
I'm sitting back here in awe at this question that Justice Bradley raised about a taxi cab driver. Do you think the law in the United States really ought to be that a taxi cab driver can give the police the right to search my luggage that's in his trunk?
I think the law contemplates that already, and that the state is asking that this court be consistent with the line of authority in other jurisdictions. In other contexts, because if that position is outrageous, then Wyoming versus Houghton is outrageous as well, and I don't think it is. The policy considerations that allowed the officer to search the belonging in Houghton apply here. And if you're concerned, if
that was a search based on probable cause,
exactly,
not consent.
Right, exactly. But the state's point is that if the passenger's privacy rights, which is really driving this, do not trump the officer's authority to search in that context, why should they trump it here? The search is equally valid, whether it's consent, probable cause, Terry, or search incident to arrest.
What's the record here? I'm not clear. When the coat pocket, jacket pocket was searched, was it outside the car?
That is not clear from the record. The defense counsel...
Doesn't that undermine your argument then that you can search anything you want in the car? I mean, if it was outside the car, and you're not sure where it was.
It was being brought outside. It's not clear when the jacket was searched, whether it was actually inside the vehicle or whether it was in the process of being taken out. Defense counsel states in his reply brief that it was in the car at the time and that Matejka couldn't see that. That simply is not...
If it's outside the car, then your argument fails, your argument that the consent of the driver authorizes search for everything in the car because it's no longer in the car.
I don't think it does, because the state's position is what is in the car at the time the consent was given, and also the people had asked for their jackets, and the officer who was getting... I recognize that Matejka did not ask for her jacket, but the officer who was grabbing those jackets out of the car didn't know. All he heard from that other officer was that they're asking for their jackets, and so then he proceeded to get them to the passengers. And it was reasonable. It was a cold day, March 16th, and people were asking for their jackets. I just want to respond briefly to some of the questions that were raised about the Terry frisk in this situation. Justice Abramson said that basically, this relates to all of the arguments advanced by the state, but that basically all this occurred because he got a that all this could occur because of a warning or a citation, but that's not what happened here. What happened was that the consent was given, and that's why the people were there. And defense counsel keeps confusing the standards required for a stop. That is, you need reasonable suspicion to believe a crime or traffic violation has been committed, with the standard required for a pat-down, which is whether the officer reasonably believes that the person may be armed. And so the people are already there. The stop is not at issue. They're there because the driver has consented to a search. And so then the state's position is, at that time, the officer had reasonable suspicion to pat them down. So regardless of whether anyone had given...
reasonable suspicion?
The reasonable suspicion? I stated those in my earlier argument, that basically it involves the same kind of factors that this court has analyzed in other cases involving Terry.
Armed? Reasonable suspicion?
Oh, I thought you were asking for the factors.
What is the reasonable suspicion?
Reasonable suspicion that they may be armed. That's what the standard is to conduct a Terry frisk.
And with the pat-down of this jacket, did they think that they've discovered a gun or a knife?
The officer testified that he was patting the jackets down for weapons.
Right. And did he think that the object he felt was a weapon?
That's unclear from the record. This issue was not raised not only in the Court of Appeals by defense counsel, but it wasn't raised in the suppression motion either. That is, even if you could get to the coat, you couldn't get inside the pockets. And so that was never developed at the hearing in this case, because the prosecutor didn't think that that was an issue and didn't go into it, and defense counsel didn't go into it, and the court didn't make any findings of fact. So I don't think this question...
So why should we deal with any of that here?
Deal with the inside of the pockets?
Yeah.
I don't think we should deal with the inside of the pockets. We should deal with the coat and assume that if the coat search was legitimate, then the pockets were. And that only applies to the Terry frisk. If we're talking about the other theories for which the officer got into the pockets, then I don't think it matters that it was the pockets versus the coat.
My understanding is the only thing raised below was the consent of the driver. That was that sufficient enough to
go into the pockets.
That's right, but I think at the hearing it was brought out by the prosecutor, at least on the issue of the of a Terry frisk, even though I don't think the word Terry is used, but the prosecutor and the officer talk about safety reasons and doing pat-downs for safety purposes.
The court of appeal, the trial court said any concern about the officer's safety could have been concluded by allowing the driver and passengers of the vehicle to return to the highway since the investigation concerning the failure to display a plate charge had been concluded. Do you disagree with that?
I vehemently disagree with that because the same could be true in the Terry frisk situation, in the case Terry itself. If the officer had concerns, she could have just walked away, or he could have let those two burglars walk away in Terry as well. Just because the officer can let someone go, I don't think that's a justification for, or that's a reason for saying that he does not have the authority to do a Terry pat-down, especially in that situation, in this situation where the driver has given consent and the people are there. I mean, why should an officer say, okay, you've given me consent, but now I'm going to let you go because I fear you may be armed? The reasonable thing is to have the people be pat down if he's afraid of his safety. And that's what occurred in this case. I think it was reasonable that the officer patted down the jacket before giving it to the people who he has concerns about.
Chief, may I ask a question?
I was wondering why we're even talking about reasonable suspicion for a pat-down. And I went to the Court of Appeals brief, and of course the Chief says, Judge Fleshour said that there was a found in favor of the defendant's press of the state appeal, and that wasn't an issue that was appealed. There was something in the brief about a Terry stop, a reasonable suspicion to stop the vehicle.
Right.
But there was nothing in the context of a pat down in the Court of Appeals brief. And of course, when we got the petition for review, that wasn't an issue. It was just this third party consent issue. So I was kind of surprised that as I was reading along halfway through my preparation, I got into reasonable suspicion for a pat-down.
That was another theory advanced by the state in its brief to sustain the Court of Appeals decision. And I recognize that defense counsel stated that the state has waived that issue. However, that is a question of judicial administration. It's not a hard and fast rule, and this court can address it.
No, but it's a different issue. Namely, you don't have the evidence in the trial court.
Well, that's why
on which to sustain a holding of this court, because that isn't the way the case was tried.
Well,
so when you get into Terry frisk, you're short of evidence. You're short of an articulation by the police officer.
If I had a chance to do a reply brief to the reply brief, that was why I was going to say waiver should not apply in this case, because I think the record is complete as far as that issue goes, that there is no additional fact-finding needed to address that issue. And also, defense counsel had an opportunity to address this issue in his reply brief. As you may know, I did not handle the case at the Court of Appeals, but I think that the record is clear and suffices to address this issue.
You can't get in their minds, but you think we would have taken this case if this were, is there reasonable suspicion, you know, fact-dependent, reasonable suspicion to do a Terry frisk?
No, I don't think you would. I think you've probably had plenty of those cases already.
Right.
But and that wasn't the only issue I addressed. That was an alternative argument that the state
the issue, and you addressed primarily the issue that was the issue that we took it for.
Right, that's the most interesting issue in this case.
And if I could just clarify on these collateral issues or secondary issues, it's your position that the underlying detention which supported the Terry frisk was not over. Is that what I heard you say?
The underlying reason to support the Terry frisk was not over at the time they...
The underlying detention. I mean,
the detention was not over.
The position of the defense attorney, as I understand it, is that the underlying detention is over, so you don't even get to the...
Well, I think you might have had an ending of the reason for the stop. I mean, at the time, he says you're free to go. And so I think that that is accurate to say that that reason had ended by the time the search occurs. But the detention hasn't ended because the driver has prolonged it. The driver has agreed to a search, and that's why they're still being held there. And so if the officer has safety concerns during that point, the officer has the right to pat them down if he reasonably believes that they may be armed.
Thank you, Ms. Nashold. Mr. Connell, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
This isn't a Terry case. It wasn't set up that way, and obviously this search wasn't a Terry search, because what the officer did, of course, was put his hands in Jennifer Matechka's pocket and pull out paraphernalia. He wasn't searching for weapons. I think it's clear from the record that what the police officer was doing and what Judge Fleischauer found was that the officer was acting on a hunch that there were narcotics in the car. He didn't have reasonable suspicion, he didn't have probable cause, and he didn't have a warrant. He didn't have consent to search Jennifer Matechka either.
Does the record reflect the race of any of these parties?
Pardon me?
Were there all white people in the car? Does the record reflect
that? The record doesn't reflect that. As a matter of fact, the record of this case doesn't even name any of the other persons that were involved, nor does it give any disposition of any of what happened to them as a result of this search, or does it detail the alleged records or probationary status of any of the people that may have been involved in this case. This case involves consent, and it involves the Fourth Amendment, and the Fourth Amendment provides protection for the fundamental right of every individual to one's privacy against governmental intrusion. The concern of our society is that is for the right of each individual to be let alone. And if we start lowering the standards for these consent searches, our privacy, everyone's privacy, will be diminished and will result in a loss of privacy. And I see all sorts of questions that have already been raised, whether taking a ride on a city bus would allow the bus driver to consent, or the captain of a ship. I wonder, reading the state's brief, whether other passengers couldn't consent to the search of a vehicle in which they're riding. And frankly, that seems to me to be just contrary to the state's position, to the expectations of privacy which underlie the Fourth Amendment. If I were to ask any of you today can I give you a ride home? Would any of you believe or expect that by accepting my invitation, you're giving me the authority to consent to a search of your coat or your purse or your briefcase? That's just not a reasonable expectation. It's one that the...
If you could consent to the police searching my jacket, why can't it be viewed that when I go into your car, I consent to you searching me?
I don't know. Obviously the Fourth Amendment deals with government intrusions, but certainly, I guess there would seem to be no difference. If I have the authority to give some other person the right to search your belongings, I probably have the same right. And that's just not contrary to, that is contrary to what a reasonable person would believe in terms of their expectations of privacy.
I don't mean to interrupt, but we're talking about the state, the authority. I don't think we're talking about personal authority to do anything. I mean, one person to search another is not what we're discussing.
Well, perhaps you're right. This case deals with the Fourth Amendment.
Right.
The Fourth Amendment deals with the rights of individuals to their personal privacy and the limits of government's intrusion on that privacy.
But you have authority then to authorize them to search my property. Now you search it yourself, and I sue you civilly and say you've invaded my property, and you say, no, I've got authority, you're in my car.
Well,
that's what the state says.
I'd cite the Court of Appeals decision if it were published, if I was being sued, sir.
Right. That's what I expected you to say.
I'm still sitting back here sort of shaking about this taxi cab driver. I've ridden with a lot of taxi cab drivers. I wouldn't want to give permission to do anything. Especially in New York. Is it your understanding of the state's position that a taxi cab driver could be driving down the street, spot an officer, pull over to the side and say, officer, you can search my passenger? You can search my passenger's belongings?
I believe that's what the state is arguing in this case, that the driver has the right to consent to the search of a passenger's belongings because that person has made the choice to ride in this vehicle. And that is the idea that I believe is contrary to the reasonable expectations of privacy.
Would the passenger, even if that's the case, would the passenger have anything to say about it?
No.
Well, it seems to me this one strain that appears in a lot of the cases is that the person whose property is being searched didn't know. And in fact, if they did know and they stand there and don't do anything about it, that suggests that they're not objecting.
I don't believe we need to object to illegal searches. I don't believe that we can acquiesce in an illegal search by our silence. And in this case, I don't believe, and I think the record establishes that Jennifer Matechka didn't know that her coat was being searched until after the fact.
Beware of bus drivers.
Well, we won't go into buses in this moment.
Never going on a bus.
And nor trains, nor airplanes. With that, we conclude the arguments in 99-0070 criminal. And